Good afternoon. I will call the House Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee to order. I will note for the record that we do have a quorum, and I will entertain a motion of approval of the minutes from February 18th. And Representative Allen, have you reviewed the minutes, and would you move their approval?
Madam Chair, I'd move their approval.
So Representative Allen so moves the minutes from February 18th. Any discussion? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Okay, so committee, we have a slight delay. The president of the University of Minnesota is on her way here. She will be here momentarily. So we're going to... She is on her way here. I'm not quite sure if she's stuck in the tunnels, Representative Hicks, but she will be here momentarily. So we are out, and she has just arrived. So welcome, President Cunningham. We just began the committee. Please join us. Welcome to the committee. Welcome to Minnesota. Welcome to the first committee hearing of the House Higher Education Committee. Thank you so much for coming and being a part of our work today. And once you get settled in, if you would state your name for the record and then tell us about yourself and the University of Minnesota. Welcome again.
Wonderful. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Dr. Rebecca Cunningham, President of the University of Minnesota. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak with you today. As Minnesota's land-grant public research university, we take our responsibility as stewards of state resources very seriously. We understand that every dollar appropriated to us by taxpayers is an investment in the future of our students, our communities, and the economic vitality of this state. This is why we're committed to spending these funds wisely, ensuring they are directed towards initiatives that provide the greatest impact. Through strategic budgeting, rigorous financial oversight, and asking ourselves to operate more efficiently, we maximize the return on public investment. The state has been in partnership with us in funding groundbreaking medical research and ensuring students have access to a world-class education. We are proud of our role in driving innovation, strengthening industries, and preparing the next generation of leaders while upholding the trust placed in us by the state. From the laboratories of our researchers to the startup ecosystem we've nurtured, our work is reshaping industries, creating jobs, and strengthening communities, our communities. We know that our healthcare industry relies on University of Minnesota graduates to be your healthcare providers. 70% of the state's physicians, as well as many of the other healthcare professionals, are a product of the University of Minnesota. There's an opportunity in front of us right now to transform healthcare for Minnesotans. As a physician, I've seen firsthand the challenges facing our healthcare system, from workforce shortages to disparities in access to care. This is why U of M is stepping up with a bold vision to enhance healthcare delivery across our state. With Essentia Health, we're proposing a bold new all Minnesota solution that provides seamless comprehensive care to patients and our best serves Minnesotans, including across greater and rural Minnesota. We believe this proposed solution is achievable, but the need for action is urgent. Without transformational vision like the one proposed, the university's commitment to best needs of the patients to educate the healthcare workforce of all Minnesota needs is at risk. Without a solution that sustains the university's mission of educating and training Minnesota's healthcare workforce of the future, a part of our core mission at the university's mission of health and medical education will change in ways that will have profound impacts for patients and all of Minnesota. This effort is not just about improving healthcare access, it's about ensuring our medical students and residents receive world-class training while staying in Minnesota to serve our communities. Finally, the university is approaching the conclusion of its MPACT 2025 strategic plan, and we are embarking on a new chapter for the University of Minnesota. This is a pivotal moment for us to reimagine the future of our institution, to chart a course that builds on our strengths while embracing new opportunities for impact. In the coming days and weeks, students, faculty, and staff are invited and are beginning to participate in a series of engagement opportunities, town halls, listening sessions, focus groups, and surveys, so that together we will gather their thoughts, ideas, and perspectives for the future of the university. This engagement will help ensure our system-wide strategic plan is not only comprehensive, but also reflective of the many voices that make up our university community and the state broadly. We're an engine of progress, a driver of economic growth, and a catalyst of innovation. From the research we conduct to the students we educate, our work shapes the lives of Minnesotans in every corner of the state. We're mindful that our decisions must serve Minnesotans effectively and responsibly. We look forward to the continuing partnership with you to ensure that Minnesota remains a leader in higher education, research, and economic growth. Thank you.
Thank you, President Cunningham. I see you've got somebody with you today. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with your presentation.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Julie Thomas, and I am the budget director for the university. And I am pleased to be here today to hopefully provide you with a good understanding of budgeting at the University of Minnesota, with particular attention to the various state appropriations as you requested. Our materials and our information will be spread over three separate committee hearings that you have offered to us. So at various points today, we will point out what will be covered today versus what will be covered next week to try to make it clear. Madam Chair, we had planned for two of us to be doing the bulk of the presentation and the slides today, but due to illness, you are unfortunately stuck with me. We will, however, with your permission, ask one of our colleagues in the audience to join us at the table to present the very last slide today, if that's all right. So today, we will provide information on our total budget and our budgeting process, how we develop our high-level plans and make decisions in that process. We will also highlight and explain how three different pieces of our state appropriation fit into the total budget and how they are being used. That deeper explanation today will be for the O&M appropriation and some of its riders, the state special for programs within the College of Science and Engineering, and a number of different programs within the system state special. Next Tuesday, we will discuss the public safety and health science appropriations, those that appear as riders to our O&M appropriation, and those that are funded through state specials. And finally, next Thursday, we will focus on the agriculture-related state specials and the research-related appropriations. We thought this structure or organization of the discussion would flow well and offer the best opportunity to understand the impact of these funds in a functional way, bringing in the right subject matter experts in an organized way to best address those issues. As these will be rather long and detailed conversations, we will leave to your discretion how you want to incorporate questions along the way. We can point out when a particular question will be addressed on an upcoming slide, but are happy to do whatever you think is best for the committee in that regard.
Thank you, Ms. Tonneson. So I think we'll take questions along the way. They seem to pop up, and then sometimes they forget by the end. And so we'll just sort of take them live as they go. And it's a little more lively discussion along the way, too. Thank
sure.
you. I'll
sure.
turn it back over to Ms. Tonneson.
All right. Thank you. So with that as an introduction, I'll begin the presentation with a high-level overview of our budget. Our fiscal year runs the same as the state of Minnesota's, July 1 to June 30. For the year we are currently in, FY25, our board approved a budget based on estimated total revenues of $4.8 billion. I will explain the different revenue categories in more detail shortly, but for this view, the red, yellow, and green represent a way of looking at the budget that's helpful in understanding how it can be managed. We have to do fund accounting, just like the state does, which means that we keep track of our funds based on how they come to us. And as part of that tracking, we are required to know which funds have restrictions placed on them by the originating entity. That is the red part of this pie. The darker red signifies the portion of our revenues that comes as grants from sponsors to do research and public service projects. That could be from the federal government, private industry, the state, foundations, etc., where the sponsoring agency often approves line item budgets for the grants and requires detailed tracking and reporting. The fire engine red piece at 18% represents additional restricted funding. So again, where the source of the funding dictates its purpose, but it is slightly less restricted in that those agencies generally do not approve line item budget level details. A donor, for example, provides a gift and says it must go to a particular school, for example, but does not necessarily signify what it has to be spent on. Or if they do, they may say it must go to a particular center within the school, for example, but not approve how much is for salaries versus equipment and so on. There are different levels of restrictions in this category. The state special appropriations would fall here, as do federal appropriations and different contract funds. The yellow segment of the pie represents what we call auxiliaries, which are the businesses of the institution that sell a product or a service to the public or to individuals, and they're large operations. Think bookstores, parking ramps, athletics, student housing and dining, and so forth. The yellow represents the concept that these operations are largely self-supporting. The rates they charge are designed to cover their costs. That isn't true in all cases or in every year, but they are generally managed to that goal, so that their activities over time do not have a significant financial impact on the rest of the university. And finally, the green represents the types of revenues that budgeting people like me like the best. They are unrestricted and they can be used to cover needs across all aspects of our mission. Here there are also two types. The light green are revenues that are generated differentially across all of our departments based on the work that's done to generate those revenues. And they flow to those budgeting units based on that work. For example, a college that sells an educational product or a byproduct, like software they've developed, seminars they put on, or honey or ice cream that they produce, keeps that revenue to pay the costs of delivering that product first, and then they can apply revenue over costs toward developing or enhancing other programmatic needs. The darker green are the state O&M appropriation and tuition, the two largest unrestricted revenue sources we have available to ensure successful delivery of our mission spread across instruction, research, and public service. Much of our focus today will be on the O&M piece of the pie. But continuing with the all funds look at the budget for just a few more minutes, a second way to view these funds is from attachment 1 to the approved FY25 budget, which the board approved last June. And this displays all revenues, state appropriation and tuition, plus all those revenues across the red, yellow, and light green categories. The amounts for the primary unrestricted funds, the first two rows for O&M and tuition, are determined for the budget based on decisions made by the state on our appropriations and decisions made by our Board of Regents regarding tuition rates coupled with projected enrollments. Those two combined are just over one-third of our projected revenues for the year. For the other funds, the estimates flow from decisions made by our board related to fees, plus our high-level estimates of changes in the other revenues based on trends and projections built from conversations with units generating those revenues. So, for example, it includes projected trend growth in gifts and growth in endowment income based on the returns in recent years, and growth in auxiliary revenues based on the approved housing and dining rates coupled with estimated occupancy and so forth. Some of these other funds might not be immediately obvious as to what they are, so let me run through just some quick illustrative examples. Starting with sales fees and miscellaneous, I've already talked about some examples, but many people don't immediately think about the large number of varied activities the university is engaged in. These miscellaneous revenues are associated with things like registration fees for non-credit courses or seminars, extension events or music lessons, admissions to the Bell Museum and concerts or dance productions, product sales associated with software development, or at the very popular Arboretum's Apple House, which I haven't been to, but I heard is wonderful. Charges to external businesses that engage our students in experiential learning projects to help them achieve their goals, beneficial to both parties, and so forth. Indirect cost recovery, the next line, is revenue from entities awarding sponsored grants to our faculty. This primarily comes from the federal government to reimburse the university for a portion of the overhead costs required to conduct that sponsored research, for the facilities and the departmental administration and the library resources and so forth. So the sponsors provide the funds for direct grant work, the line item budgets they approve for faculty and lab personnel and equipment, et cetera, and then they provide a percent over and above that project award to help pay for the large infrastructure costs that often benefit the full portfolio of the grants.
Thank you. We're going to take a small break, and Representative Wolgamott has a question.
Right. Well, thank you so much, Madam Chair. Madam President, Madam Vice President, welcome to the Higher Education Committee. We look forward to a good, strong partnership between you and our committee and the university to have good communication and good accountability, and that starts here. So thank you for being here. Madam Chair, my question is for both the Vice President and President. In talking about the amount of federal appropriations and how that affects the budget, can you please shed some more light on how what's happening right now with cuts at the federal level could potentially change these numbers or impact these numbers? And then specifically, I was very concerned to hear of the NIH reduction to IDC rates at the federal level. It's my understanding that would cut $150 million out of the budget. Could you please share with the committee the impact that $150 million cut would have on the numbers on the spreadsheet and would have on the university's budget as a whole? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Lead Wolgamott. So I know that that'll be probably later in the slide because right now we're on the general appropriations specific to the NIH money. And when I was looking at that, I remember the amount of money that was coming in 23 versus 24 is, I believe, the increase is actually the projected increase was larger than the decrease from NIH. So it's kind of a, to me, it looked like a wash, but not a wash. Okay. So I know that you also get money from DOD, DOE, the state of Minnesota, some local grants as well. So it's a big pile, a big pot of money over that. The number we had before was $1.3 billion in research money, and I know that's an old number. I think that was from 23, but I believe it went up to $1.4 billion. So I'm sure you've got those slides in here as well, because we had talked about that before.
Madam Chair.
So we'll go back to President Cunningham.
Yeah. Madam Chair and Representative, I'd be happy to answer a little bit of that question directly around the NIH funds and the proposed cuts to the IDC rates. We do have a total expenditures at the university of about $1.3 or $1.4 billion. This is overwhelmingly money that we take, that we get from the federal government and we bring here to Minnesota. As one of the benefits of your research university is we bring external dollars from the federal government in a large amount to the university, which is then spent on jobs, communities, discovery, and innovation that then rolls out to turn into the 25 startups that we had last year, which then creates small businesses and growth and economic development. So a huge part of what we do. The largest source of those funds is NIH, overwhelmingly, for us. Our current negotiated rate, all universities have a negotiated rate for their indirect costs with the federal government. Our current negotiated rate is 54%. If that were to move to 15%, it would be an immediate cut of between $100 and $130 million to the university next year. And what that would mean is it'd be a direct cut, really, to our research. You can't fund individual researchers if you don't fund the equipment that they need to do the work on or the buildings they need to work in or the utilities for that building. So it would absolutely gut our ability to do biomedical discovery research, which would have a direct impact in our ability to contribute to the med tech and biomedical innovations in the state, as well as really most importantly, from my physician's standpoint, is it would dramatically impact the ability to produce biomedical cures and discovery and technologies that actually all of our patients in our communities need. So it would be a tremendous cut to the university that would gut our research mission. I would also add train over 9,000 graduate students every year. Those graduate students are funded on grants often. They're working in labs and with equipment that are funded by this research directly, and a cut to that would dramatically impact the ability to train graduate students around the country in advance and concern of this. There are universities that are already beginning to cut back how many graduate students they would accept, which obviously would lead to less scientists in our community, to less people working in our labs and pharmacies, et cetera. So it would have dramatic impacts.
Thank you, President Cunningham. So what I was referring to was something that we had a presentation before the Democrats joined us here at the legislature. And I believe it was in 23 that you had $1.3 billion, even $1.31, I think, billion dollars in overall research money that had come in out of your nearly $5 billion overall budget. But then I was told that that was an old number. And so the new number, when we looked at the chart, was tremendous growth over the quite a few years, and that in 2024 it was actually, it had exceeded $1.4 billion. And what I was referencing is, if you go the difference between $1.31 billion and $1.41 or $2 billion, that's nearly the cut that you're talking about. That's what I was referring to, that the growth that you saw from 23 to 24 is almost the same as the cut that you're talking about from NIH. And that's where I was having a hard time understanding why, you know, if you're just going back to previous numbers. So but you explained it a little bit more. But in overall money coming into the University of Minnesota for research, it's reverting back to where you were in 23 as far as the overall numbers.
Madam Chair, I think about it a bit differently than that. So every year, we're an amazing research university. We're top 12 in the country for research universities, which is an amazing gift for Minnesota. There's 50 states, and we are an economic engine in the top 12 for the country, for the state. Every year, we increase our research portfolio by about 6%, 7%, 8%, and as do our peers. So we continue to then get the market share that we need from, to keep us competitive as a state and as a university from the government. So, but you can't simply equate the drop in expenditures, because really what this would be cutting would be gutting the overhead infrastructure components. And we wouldn't be able to accept the other dollars if we don't have the money. I can't accept money for you as a researcher to do X, Y, and Z experiment if you don't have the bench for them to work at and the building for them to be in and the equipment that they need. So we would not be able to accept an awful lot of research, including research from the state, which actually we help pay for by having the infrastructure funding that we get from the federal government. So while we would be gutted, many other universities would also be gutted. And as a nation, what that would mean would basically be the devastation of our biomedical research complex for the world. And we're considered leaders in the world on this.
I think Representative Cleburne has a question as well. And was there one over here too?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And I really appreciate your being here. And it's very nice to get to meet you in this capacity. So welcome to Minnesota.
Thank you.
Yesterday on the radio, we heard, I can't believe I'm saying it, but thank you, Alabama, because Alabama has raised the alarm about how these NIH cuts would impact their entire state. And I think Minnesota, I represent Plymouth and Medicine Lake, and Plymouth has a great deal of medical research that depends on the research that comes out of the University of Minnesota. So whether we're talking about the actual medical device or whether we're talking about the cures that come from these research labs. But my question around the grants themselves is, I don't understand, and I haven't heard anything about this, but when the university has accepted grants in the past, let's say 2 years or 3 years, you know, there's an expectation that you will deliver upon those grants. Is there any possibility that there, and because I haven't heard anybody ask this, is there any possibility there would be a reach back for monies that have already been spent or already been allocated because we can't fulfill the terms of the grant as we had stated when the money was given to the institution? Is that a real issue? Has anybody talked about what that impact might be on the institution?
President Cunningham.
I'll start and then let my colleague jump in here. So I think we're all trying to analyze what the intent and actual impact will be of the federal directives that are coming down. And so I wouldn't want to speak to whether it would be a reach back or going forward until we all sort of understand where it is and where it's paused and where it's not paused and what it would mean going forward. But it would certainly impact our ability to continue to do research grants. You're correct, are often given out in 5 year. They're given out every year, but their researchers will get a 5 year grant, and then every year they will get the annual portion of that grant when they've fulfilled with a lot of accountability what they had to do the year before. So yes, what could happen and what there have been people talking about nationally is if you're in year two or three of your grant and you suddenly don't have the funding for that to go forward, might there be clinical trials that stop? Might there be other research that's left hanging? There certainly would be jobs that would be eliminated. I have many researchers across the university emailing us with quite a fair amount of panic over concern of what this would mean for their jobs and their positions. Here, remember, we have thousands and thousands and thousands of our university employees are actually completely funded on federal grants, so this would impact jobs in our communities tremendously. I don't know if
Ms. Tonneson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I want to offer just a few points of clarification that I think might help as you look at the conversation we've just been having relative to the numbers you see on this page or the budget itself. So the dollars you were referencing, Madam Chair, the $1.3 billion, $1.4 billion, our research enterprise keeps track of the sponsored activity in many different ways. And one way is by total awards. Awards, as President Cunningham just mentioned, might be, I'm going to give you $5 million over 5 years. Well, it might be counted as $5 million award, but when you look at the budget, they're only going to spend $1 million in year one. So if you look at this chart that's up on the screen today, there's two lines that impact what we've been, or are impacted by what we've been talking about. One is the ICR line at $236 million. That is the overhead we're getting, or anticipate to get, from our sponsors in 1 year. So this is FY25. This is the budget, the estimated amount in the overhead reimbursements we're anticipating to get. The second line is down at the bottom where it says resource expenditures multi-year sponsored funds, the $830 million. That represents our estimate of the actual direct grant spending that will happen that year that we will get reimbursed on. Because how it generally works is the revenues cover each year what is spent on each individual grant. So the award number generally never equals what the actual expenditures are in a given year because of that multi-year nature of budgeting. So when we're talking about losing $100 million in ICR in 1 year, it would actually reduce that $236 million down to $136. And then there would be, over time, the impacts President Cunningham was talking about in terms of actually reducing the number of grants and therefore the direct grant funding that we're getting. So that 830 would also decrease over time as we're able to accept fewer grants. I hope that helps clarify just a little bit the connection to the budget.
Yep, so Representative Cleavorn, and then we're gonna keep going or we will not finish today.
So as an R1 institution, a research, primary research institution, can you tell me, so we have lots of different departments, right? NIH is getting the attention right now because that's the latest bomb. But I'm wondering, how would the Department of Education, what's happening to the Department of Education, what impact would that have on our institution as well, or USDA, or any of the other major programs that come in? And I know then the state coffers will also be impacted, but the direct appropriations to the institution from, let's say, the Department of Education or the Department at USDA.
President Cunningham.
I'll start, Madam Chair, Representative. First, it's important to know that NIH funds things even far beyond our medical school and health sciences. They fund a large chunk of the engineering research that's done, for example, work that's done across our veterinary school that impacts, you know, our public health from assessing bird flu and protecting the state's poultry production, et cetera. So it's a wide range that they fund. In terms of the most recent DOE announcement, dear colleague letter on Friday, I think we're still in the middle of assessing as a university what that would mean if enacted in that component and assessing to ensure, you know, we are currently in compliance of that, which we believe we likely are. But this is certainly the analysis that we're doing now to ensure that.
Okay.
If this happened with other agencies, then that number would go from the estimated 100 to 130 million. If that happened and flowed across the DOD or the other agencies, then we would have even more than that. And I do know, for example, there's been major sections of NSF cut recently. For example, NSF had big programs around semiconductors with their NSF engines program. I understand that's been put on pause. That would dramatically reduce the country's ability to manage semiconductor competitiveness globally. And we certainly have faculty and researchers doing that sort of work as well. So that would also then be downstream cuts and effects to those programs. And I can't emphasize enough, research is also teaching. So this does not just affect our researchers. This affects our graduate students tremendously and our undergraduate students that are getting good training on those grants.
Okay, and we have one final thing from Lead Wolgamont, and then we'll need to move on.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair. Madam President, Madam Vice President, thank you for those answers. Frankly, I find them alarming, the impact that these cuts would have on the mission of the university is, I think, the wrong step by far that we should be taking. We need to be investing in empowering the work that is done in our nation-leading, world-leading research and development. This is a devastating step back. So again, thank you for those answers. If there's any information that you could get us in writing about the impact that these cuts would have both on research and development, also the job loss, we would really appreciate that. And it's our hope that we can work together to stop these cuts and continue to invest in the great work that you're doing. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, back to Ms. Tonneson.
All right. Moving on, the auxiliary enterprises line, which is where we left off, the next row there, that is the revenue I mentioned earlier from sales made by our businesses, housing, dining, bookstores, parking, and so forth. Private practice, these are clinical revenues that flow into the university to support the administration of clinical services and some programming in the medical school and in our School of Dentistry. Federal appropriations, you mentioned that just a moment ago. These are some very specific agriculture-related annual appropriations that are here, the $19.8 million, that go to Extension and the Ag Experiment Station only. It supports actually many of the same activities that the Agricultural State Special supports. Gifts and endowment income, that might be obvious what that is. These are the amounts that actually come into the university from the foundation in any given year, from individual gifts that should be spent immediately and also from earnings on the endowment. Restricted grants and contracts are non-sponsored agreements with public and private entities to do work. So they're not the sponsored grants that we were just talking about. This is where items such as the state's AGREET funding to CFANS is recorded, if you're familiar with that, which is an agreement with the state's Department of Agriculture. This is where our federal and state student aid dollars are recorded and where contract revenue with private and public organizations such as hospitals are recorded.
We have a question from Representative Robbins really quickly, and then we'll move on.
Thank you. Thank you, President Cunningham, for being here. Ms. Tonneson, nice to see you again. You're exceptionally good at this. I just had a couple questions on this slide. So what else is in the state special? You mentioned something for ag, but could you explain more what's in that fund?
Madam Chair, Representative Robbins, actually we are going to go into detail on the state specials today, Tuesday and Thursday, so hopefully you'll see what that total is coming up here.
Yep. Representative Robbins.
Thank you. Thank you for that. And also on the gifts and endowment income, how much of that is gifts versus just interest on the endowment? Go
ahead. Madam Chair, Representative, the, as we answer that, I want to point out first that it's really important for folks to know the gifts and endowment is overwhelmingly designated. So when a donor provides funds, they provide funds they want to give to a scholarship fund, or they provide funds that they want to give to a center to help with a particular kind of research on bones. We do not have discretion to move that around and suddenly use it for other costs that are unanticipated or other components. We have signed contracts with all of the donors for what the intent is of that gift, and we have to honor the intents of those gifts. And overwhelmingly, I believe 95% of the income represented, it's higher, 98% of that is designated, predetermined. We cannot alter the intent from our donors, and donors overwhelmingly, and this is true across the country, we raise substantial funds for our university. Our foundation is in the top three in the Big Ten for the amount of funds that we raise for our university. So we work very hard with our alumni, who are very, very generous and very supportive. And overwhelming, those funds go to scholarships, to student support, to faculty support, to be able to keep costs down for the students. But it's really important for folks to understand that is, that is not a piggy bank. We can't rearrange it. It's designated by the donor at the time. And after their death, indeed, often those funds continue to give, and they give in the donor intent that wasn't intended at the time of their signing.
Okay, yes. Let's move on. Yes. Ms. Tonneson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, and also Representative Robbins, great question. I've pulled a lot of detail. That isn't one of the pieces of detail I pulled for today, so we are happy to get you the split between those two after today. And as President Cunningham said, all that restriction means they're part of the red part of the pie chart that you saw earlier. But to close out the big picture from an all funds perspective for this portion of the discussion, I thought it might be useful to share how the university's dependence on our different buckets of funding has changed over time. In 1990, the state provided 39% of university revenues, which, as you can see, has now dropped to a low of 16% in FY25. In response to less state support, sometimes in real dollars and over time in inflation-adjusted dollars, plus the fact that our cost of operation increase even if we are standing still, the university has become more dependent on tuition revenue, which was 12% of our total revenues in 1990 and has stabilized quite a bit since 2008 in that 22 to 25% range. It is 23% of our projected revenues today, down slightly from 25% more recently. And at the same time, we have worked really hard to raise other types of revenue to cover costs and provide an edge of excellence in our activities wherever possible. As encouraged by the Board of Regents, in recent years, we've been able to move our dependence on these other revenue sources from 48% of the total in 1990 to now 61%, a strong majority. We've seen strong growth in three primary areas: grants, sales income, and gifts. Since 2020, grants alone have increased in the 7 to 11% range each year. These revenues support many varied activities, as we've been discussing, and are essential, really, for running today's institution. We're doing our part, but this balancing game continues to get more difficult. So we are, again, asking the state to help us, to partner with us, on addressing true financial needs to maintain the excellence we have built and to expand our reach in support of students and families and a healthy Minnesota. We'll return to our some notes about our requests later in the presentation. But next, I want to take us into a discussion of the budget process and how we go about making decisions and pulling it all together. So we think about the revenues in the budgeting process in two different ways. First, those at the institutional level. The president and the board make decisions that directly impact these resources, and that's the tuition level and the O&M state appropriation. They decide what to ask for from the state of Minnesota for the appropriation, and they decide on the tuition rates. For all other revenues, through the budget, the board does decide on rates. They approve fees and housing and dining rates for students, but by and large, the budgeting units manage those revenues and the corresponding expenditures for all of those other funds. The two groups are treated differently, but they come together in the final budget, and they are all reviewed as part of the budgeting process. Today, we're going to focus on the process for making decisions, which includes the process for distribution of the state funds. To understand budgeting at the university, it's necessary to understand our fiscal management structure. When we say unit, as we like to say, in this context. We're talking about the level of the institution we in central administration hold accountable for the financial activity that occurs within it. The leaders of these units have to make decisions about and manage their budgets, and they are subject to central oversight, monitoring, and decisions that directly impact their finances as well. We call these units RRCs, which stands for Resource Responsibility Centers. For budgeting, it's helpful to understand these RRCs in two major groups. Those we consider academic, that do the mission work, and those are the ones you see on this particular slide. This includes the four campuses outside of the Twin Cities, and then the colleges and other academic units you see below the line. And on this slide, you see the second group of RRCs. Those we refer to as support units because they provide the services that are critical to achieving our mission, that are in support of the academic work done in the academic units. This group includes the 26 RRCs you see above the line, many of which have system-wide responsibilities, while some are providing services only to the Twin Cities units. And it includes the two Twin Cities-based auxiliary operations below the line. The auxiliary operations on the Greater Minnesota campuses are included within the campus unit budgets that were on the previous page. There are 51 budgeting units today. The breakdown of the units in this way is helpful as we explain the budget and the oversight process as we go forward in the conversation. So from a cycle perspective, the budget process looks like this, and it all starts with the black box in the upper left-hand corner. In the summer of an even-numbered year, we build what we call the budget framework, which is a plan particularly focused on the O&M and tuition part of the budget of how we are going to move forward in balancing that budget based on a handful of variables. And they have to balance. So much like the state, we create and have approved a balanced budget every year. We have done that every year since I've been there in 31 years. So we have a balanced budget. So when we build this framework, we're talking about incremental changes in resources and incremental changes in spending that, as you plan, have to balance. The resources have to be equal to or greater than the expenditures. And if that happens, we know we have a balanced budget moving forward. The variables I'm talking about here are things like, what do we ask for from the state of Minnesota, which we can't do in a vacuum. We have to do that in the context of the university's full budget. So we have to ask, what do we want to do about tuition? What do we want to do about asking our units to internally reallocate funds? So to create budget cuts, spending cuts, to free up existing resources to spend on something else. We ask ourselves, what do we want to plan for compensation? What do we know about required cost increases for utilities and fringe benefits and inflation? And what do we want to plan for in terms of strategic pool investments in moving the university forward? So that rough set of variables has to come together in a balanced way, and that creates a plan for the budgeting process. And out of that comes our request to the state of Minnesota for the next biennium, which you see here in the maroon boxes. The timeline for that, we asked the board to review and approve our proposal in the fall, in September and October of an even-numbered year. We submit it to MMB. We work through the governor's process on their timelines. We are here today. We'll work with the legislature during session, and hopefully we will know what our appropriation is for the next 2 years by the end of May. Simultaneously, however, we can't stand still on our annual budget. So simultaneously, we take the planning assumptions in that black box, we turn them into budget instructions to our units. We actually start that process, the 51 units. We start that process in September. We work with them all the way through until May, and I'll explain more about how that works and how the decision-making process works. And ultimately, we have to pull it all together once we know our appropriation and our estimates for everything else, and it all has to balance. And we bring the budget to the board for review and action in June. The second year of the biennium runs very similarly on the annual budget side, except we don't have to submit another biennial request to the state. We tweak the black box for that second year based on new information, changes in the appropriation we know about, new cost obligations that come up, and so forth. We tweak the black box, but the process runs the same way. In a biennial cycle like this, when we decide on the state appropriation request, that is just one of the variables we work with to arrive at our budget plans. It is a direct result of modeling the costs and the revenues during the development of those black box plans I mentioned, and determining the best general fit for all of the variables within that overall budget plan. The whole process starts with development of that framework. And as you can see, the framework focuses on the tuition and state appropriation part of the budget, with changes in the other funds only coming in at the margin. Because as I mentioned, they have to cover their own costs for those activities first, and then when possible, they help us solve budget challenges on what would traditionally be funded out of the state and tuition dollars when that's possible. This is because of all, and we have to think about them differently because of the characteristics I mentioned earlier about all of these other funds. The budgeting process has to get to the decisions about each of these variables, which is determined in part by the projected costs and the investments that are planned for those funds. Internally, while the president and the board make the final decisions on the budget, the process actually is dependent on the input of many different people. It's a very distributed budget management model with a good deal of consultation. So the president is the one who decides on the plans, the black box plans, if you will, the variables and how to move forward with planning, sometimes in ranges, but there are decisions made about how to move forward in planning. And then she has delegated to what's called the budget committee management of the budget process. There's a group of six of us that work together as institutional officers. We take those black box assumptions, turn them into budget instructions that we then send out to our units, the 51 you saw. Those units, the leaders, can actually operate the budget process within their unit as works best for them. They're not all the same. Sometimes they have a very participative process. Sometimes it involves fewer people, but they have to respond to the budget instructions. So they send their responses up to the budget committee. We work together to create recommendations to the president, and then through an iterative process back and forth, she makes changes to what we recommend, asks for more information, and so forth. And ultimately, we end up with a budget recommendation that goes to the board for review and action. The departments across the university, those are the level underneath the RRC. Think about the Department of English, for example, in the College of Liberal Arts. How those departments are involved in the budget process depends upon the leader of that unit and how they choose to structure the input into the budget process. To help in this process, we operate under what's called a responsibility center management budget model, which is just a tool that helps us translate that high-level budget planning decision-making variables down to the unit level, so we can better understand the potential impact of our decisions, which leads to better decisions overall. In our model, we have decision rules for the attribution of revenues and costs. This is a high-level picture on this chart of how the revenues and the costs flow in our model. But for right now, I want to focus just on the right side in that kind of peach-colored box. As I mentioned earlier, most of the revenues are generated by activity in the departments, and the revenues flow to them from that activity, sometimes at the department level and sometimes at the RRC level. So tuition, at the top of the list here, automatically flows to the college and the campuses, 100%, based on actual student registration in courses and based on where the students are enrolled. And the other revenues do the same based on which units are generating it. The Apple House revenues that I mentioned earlier go directly to the Arboretum. And the indirect costs we've been talking about associated with the sponsored grants flow to the college or the campus of the unit that the relevant faculty member is a part of, and so on. The state appropriation, which is separated out here in the box in our model, is not allocated based on a formula. The state specials flow as directed in law, which we will talk about here in a few minutes, and the O&M appropriation is allocated in a base plus minus process, just like the state process for the general fund. And we will talk about that more in a few minutes as well. For now, it's important to note that essentially 100% of the state O&M appropriation is allocated to the academic unit RRCs within the system, so that first page of units. The right side of this chart, the allocation of the costs, I'll get back to that after focusing first on the state appropriations. And to do that, per the committee's request, we'll start by providing additional details on the appropriations in from the 2023 session, Chapter 41. Throughout this portion of the presentation, we'll reference the Higher Education Finance Spreadsheet dated May 30, 2023, rows 193 through 242 on pages 6 and 7. You should have a copy of the spreadsheet in your committee packet if my information is correct. We're specifically using this spreadsheet as the university did not receive any additional funding during the 2024 session. So we'll begin our walk through the appropriations with an overview of how the university allocates and manages the state special appropriation. These are noted on rows 222 through 233 of the higher education spreadsheet that I just mentioned. The state specials are distributed internally consistent with designations in law or consistent with historical legislative work papers when the appropriation language itself is not specific as to the amount by unit or program. These work papers were historical agreements between the university and the legislature at one time, and the university continues to honor the original intent of the law. For example, the amount of the system special going to the Humphrey Forum versus the amount going to the Bell Museum is not in law. But back in the 1990s, we had legislative work papers that did include that level of detail, so we have maintained consistency with those original details. In years that the state special appropriations were reduced in law, the unit or programs within each were reduced proportionately to maintain consistency with that original intent. To support the financial management of the state specials, each has a separate fund code within the university's accounting system, allowing the university to manage the funds and monitor expenditures through its annual budget process and associated budget entry, as well as periodic audits by the university's Office of Internal Audit. And I'll address the various oversight aspects of state funding on a later slide. As we talk through the appropriations, we'll note how the state special funds are used and if additional university resources are needed to supplement the state special funds in order to deliver the programs. As you know, the state special funding has remained stagnant over quite some time, so inflation has eaten away at the buying power of those resources. Today, we'll focus on a subset of the state specials, including the state special for the College of Science and Engineering, as well as portions of the system special, including the funds allocated to the Center for Urban and Regional Affairs, UMD's Bureau of Business and Economic Research, Labor Education Services in the Carlson School of Management, and the Humphrey School's Humphrey Forum. Details on the other state specials will be provided at the hearing on February 25th and on February 27th, when specific experts will be present who can discuss the university's public safety, health, science, agriculture, and research-related appropriations. I will say as I walk through these next several slides, if it sounds like I'm reading the material and it's not in my voice, that's because that's the case. I am familiar with these items, but we asked our program and unit experts to help us out with the qualitative descriptions and what's actually taking place, and I want to honor their contributions by relaying the information as they've described it. As noted on the Higher Education Finance Spreadsheet on row 225, the Twin Cities Campus College of Science and Engineering receives $1,140,000 in an appropriation each year. It was for many years called the IT Special. That's because the college used to be called the Institute of Technology. They have since changed their name. This state special partially funds the operation of two programs, the Minnesota Geological Survey and the Talented Youth Mathematics Program, both of which serve the state of Minnesota and meet targeted state needs. The Minnesota Geological Survey was established in 1872 by the state of Minnesota and is a research and service arm of the School of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the university within the College of Science and Engineering. Its purpose is to provide geoscience information to support stewardship of land, water, and mineral resources. The Minnesota Geological Survey, or MGS, receives base funding through the university in the form of an O&M allocation that is used primarily for professional and administrative personnel costs, and then they receive this state special of $846,111 that is used to cover personnel, equipment, laboratory analysis, and travel for a variety of purposes, including research, that's in addition to other sponsored projects. It includes support and matches for mapping programs, support for conferences, and public education and outreach. While much of the focus is currently on county geologic atlas mapping, the MGS performs other research and provides geologic and hydrologic information and technical advice upon request to units such as DNR, Ecological and Water Resources, MDH, Water Well Management and Drinking Water Divisions, MPCA Remediation Staff, and MDA Pesticide and Fertilizers Division, as well as many private sector environmental consulting firms and the general public. The University of Minnesota Talented Youth Mathematics Program, the second in this series for the College of Science and Engineering, we affectionately call UMPTYUMP, is one of the nation's premier accelerated math programs. Each year, the program serves 550 to 650 highly talented students from middle schools and high schools across the state. Through this program, students can fulfill their high school math requirements as well as earn college credits as a middle or high school student. UMPTYUMP families pay up to $1,525 each year, but this is considerably short of the cost to run the program and less than what a college calculus student pays for a class, for example. Similar to the post-secondary enrollment options program, the $293,890 in state special funding helps offset that gap in tuition. Currently, the state special is used to cover salaries and fringe for 23 UMPTYUMP instructors and 14 undergraduate teaching assistants. Most of the instructors are high school teachers in the Twin Cities and Rochester area who teach the lower level courses, and 7 are faculty and instructors from the Twin Cities and Rochester campuses who teach the higher level courses. Moving to the system special, it can be found on row 226 of the higher education spreadsheet. The spreadsheet notes the total appropriation of $9,181,000 in fiscal years 24 and 25, but within that, there are a number of different programs receiving funding in alignment with those historical work papers I mentioned previously. We will walk through 4 of the system special allocations today and provide details on the other 5 next week when we have additional experts in the room. The first allocation is for the Center for Urban and Regional Affairs. This center receives $985,496 of the system special, and combined with a university O&M allocation of over $1 million and some small amount of miscellaneous sales income, its work is focused on the university's research and public service missions. 93% of the state special is spent on compensation. The funds support all aspects of the center's mission across the state of Minnesota. Specifically, it supports faculty and students doing course-based projects for local governments through a Resilient Communities program. It supports faculty and graduate students doing research on issues related to the state of Minnesota, graduate research assistants providing mapping assistance to over 50 community groups statewide each year. It supports leadership training for more than 400 community leaders over the past 8 years through the Neighborhood Leadership and Organizing Program, and graduate research assistants to do applied research and technical assistance to community groups and local government agencies across the state on topics chosen by those local groups. The second allocation here of $39,211 is for the Bureau of Business and Economic Research at UMD. This allocation dates back to 1967 and the founding Bureau of Business and Economic Research at UMD for the purpose of publishing the monthly Duluth Business Index. This index continues to be widely used today by Duluth and regional businesses, the media, and others who monitor and strategize economic development across Northeast Minnesota. It's considered a vital resource for this region of the state, and the state special offsets a portion of the total cost of the work led by UMD on behalf of the region. To continue to support this work, the $39,211 is supplemented with funds such as O&M, external sales, and gifts. The system state special also supports industrial and labor relations education in the Carlson School of Management. This allocation of $777,533 is primarily spent on compensation. The funds, supplemented only by a small amount of non-credit fee income, are used to provide training and classes to unions and workers on relevant issues such as leadership, negotiation, labor law, labor history, and social justice organizing. In addition, Carlson's Labor Education Services has the Workday magazine and website, which is an online labor news publication, the first online labor news organization in the United States. The last allocation here to the Humphrey School of Public Affairs for $91,942 is used for public engagement and public education, fostering the spirit of Hubert H. Humphrey's legacy. These events draw attendees from the University of Minnesota and the broader community and often tie into debates happening across the state in the legislature and in election activities. Examples of these events include public forums with candidates for statewide election and workshops with legislative leaders and the governor's office on election administration, government redesign, and other pressing issues. Funds are specifically used for honorariums and travel for speakers, audiovisual services for events, other event-related supplies and expenses, and staffing to coordinate events and schedule speakers. The state special funds were supplemented with $130,000 in gifts in FY24, which doesn't happen every year. As I mentioned, the remaining state specials on your spreadsheet will be addressed in our presentations next week. Moving next to the large unrestricted appropriation, the University of Minnesota's Operations and Maintenance, or O&M, appropriation is made up of an annual block grant to support our general operations, as well as riders within that specify use of portions of the appropriation for specific legislative priorities. Of the list of riders, today's discussion will focus on those related to the Morris campus, the unemployment insurance reimbursement, and menstrual products. The other riders will be covered on February 25th or February 27th. Under Minnesota Statutes 137.16, the university is required to provide free tuition for American Indian students who meet the requirements defined in that section of statute. This population of students is broader than the student population covered by the new American Indian Scholars Program established in Chapter 41. In total, the Morris campus will provide approximately $4.1 million in tuition waivers for American Indian students in this academic year. Of that amount, approximately $1 million will be covered by the American Indian Scholarship Program, and $500,000 will be covered by this appropriation rider, leaving a $2.6 million gap in waived tuition that is covered primarily with the university's general O&M allocation to the campus. The $500,000 is part of that O&M funding allocation to the campus, which is roughly $29 million this year, and is used to cover general operating expenses as those listed here on the bottom of the slide, the same list of expenses that the waived tuition would have supported. Unemployment insurance is a second rider that just began this biennium. Chapter 41 made changes to unemployment insurance statutes to include non-exempt non-professional employees who are in 9 and 10 month appointments, adding benefits for individuals during summer break and between terms. The recently submitted report on this new requirement displayed a total of roughly $368,000 that was paid to this eligible population between academic terms during the summer of 2024. The second year report to be completed after summer 2025 will include the annual change in reimbursable costs as required, which we couldn't do yet with only 1 year of activity under the law. The appropriation for year one was very close to the amounts that were paid out. Finally, the menstrual products rider is also new for this biennium. Chapter 41 created a new section of statute 135A.1365, asking the university to provide menstrual products in all restrooms used by students. Chapter 41 also appropriated funds for the university to purchase the necessary equipment and supplies to meet this new requirement, $374,000 in FY24 and $110,000 on an ongoing basis. To distribute the appropriation, the university reviewed the number of restrooms on all five campuses, data on restrooms that had already had dispensers, and the type of dispensers already used on each campus. Given this data, the university then proportionally distributed the dollars to ensure each campus had the funds it needed to purchase, install, and stock the dispensers. Implementations varied by campus given the number of restrooms and the number of dispensers that were required or needed. They all intend to use the recurring funds to continue stocking the dispensers moving forward. I do have detailed information from each of the campuses on implementation of this rider if there are questions about it.
Ms. Tonneson, I think that Representative Knorr had a question.
Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Madam President, and Madam Vice President, welcome. Just wanted to ask a previous question. You know, I haven't seen a data in terms of the number of students. Have we seen a growth? Because I previously that was number one question. And since the tuition has gone down, I was prompted to ask that question because you also mentioned PSEO, and I just wanted to know how all that is tied together, because I've been asking to increase the number of students taking PSEO through the University of Minnesota. But the initial question is, have we seen a drastic change of the number of students enrolled at the University of Minnesota?
President Cunningham?
Madam Chair, Representative, so I'll take the beginning part of that and then turn it over. We have a record high number of students at the University of Minnesota this year. We have over 70,000 students enrolled, which is an all-time high in 40 or 50 years. So we're very excited about that. We have that enrollment is up across almost all of our campuses, and I think reflects the wonderful education that the university provides, at the value that it's able to provide it, due to both our tuition and the value. We remain with the generous. I think one of the other reasons our enrollment is up certainly is with the generous amount of scholarship funds that we provide and the generous amount of financial aid that we provide. We are the most affordable four-year institution in the state of Minnesota for our students who come from backgrounds of under $110,000 of family income. So we provide this amazing value of a research-based education with the opportunities to work with world-class faculty. For those students who are the least privileged, we provide that at the most affordable rate across the state of Minnesota. So we're very pleased with those numbers. I think there was a second part of the question.
Madam Chair, Representative Knorr, I do not have with me today the number of PSEO students in the system. My memory is old, probably several years old, so we can promise to get you that next week when we're back.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That will be helpful because it has always been less than even 400 compared to a number of 1,500 students who apply each year. So my goal is to see that we can also provide online. The reason why I asked the question about the number of students, because you mentioned the tuition has gone down compared to 25 to 23, but also is the North Star Promise Act helping the number of students who are enrolling at the U?
President Cunningham?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'll take the first part of that again. So our tuition has not gone down. Unfortunately, we've had to continue to raise our tuition. However, our tuition as a percentage of our overall operating income, we've managed to hold down. I mean, there's inflation and all those other pieces that we have to keep up with. However, partly because of the grants we get and our increased focus on getting grants and that great IDC rate that we get, as well as by our increased fundraising and other revenues, we've been able to hold down the proportion of our overall operating expenses that are related to tuition compared to past years. So is that the first part or second part?
Ms. Tonneson?
Second part was Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we'll wait for the 25th and the 27th. There's several questions on specific areas, including safety and others. I think we can wait for the 25th and the 27th. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Duran.
Thank you guys for being here. Looking at the unemployment insurance, it kind of sparked a question in my head, and I don't know if you guys are going to cover this a little bit later or not, but is there going to be a drastic impact on the university from the sick and safe time or the paid family leave at all?
President Cunningham.
Madam Chair, Representative Duran, we are just moving into safe and sick time, and of course the Family Medical Leave Act has not actually been implemented yet. I believe it's scheduled for January of 2026 that it becomes actionable, but we are planning for it. So yes, the safe and sick time is having some impact on some categories of employees in terms of the budget, because we do have to pay things that we didn't have to pay before. But that is not true for all of our employee groups. So I would have to get you information on exactly which employees now are being paid as a result of that, more than they otherwise would have been. The Family Medical Leave Act, we are still working out implementation of that with the state on how best to implement that. There are choices that we have to make around going through the state or contracting with a private outside firm to deliver that benefit, and that is an ongoing discussion right now at the university.
Representative Duran.
Thank you. Yeah, that'll be some really good information for us to have as well, for the breakdown of the effects of sure. what it's going to have on the university.
Sure.
All right, thank you.
Great. So just to be clear, too, I know there was a question about increased enrollment. You have control over your enrollment because you can either accept or decline to accept a student, unlike Penn State, where they're an open enrollment. So what was the decision to increase your own student population by 10,000? President Cunningham.
So the there were university goals as part of the Impact 2025 strategy for the past couple of years to increase enrollment in places that we had capacity to do that across the system, including across our system campuses that were hurt badly across our COVID time. And so in some ways that's bringing enrollment back to levels that they had before. In bringing our enrollment to the levels that we think we can provide and making sure that we have the opportunity to provide as for as many students, especially across the state of Minnesota, that we can provide this value in education as possible. Yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure that the committee and the public know that you control how many students that you have, unlike Minn State, because they're an open enrollment, and you can either accept students or not, and I know you're still struggling in some of your outstate Morris, for example, and Crookston are still struggling with some students there. So, President
Madam Chair, one of the things our board has tasked me with this year is coming up with a full enrollment strategy and plan across the system to address what our enrollment will be to be right-sized, as well as to manage what is the demographic cliff that is coming across the country. For high school students, the number of high school students graduating, which will be particularly hit in Minnesota, and how we then work to keep those students here in Minnesota and have the fewer students that are graduating from our high schools, to have them continue to choose Minnesota as opposed to going out of state.
Sure. Representative Allen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for taking the time to be here today. Back to Representative Duran's question about sick and safe time. I think of the people here. I'm the only one that's worked in research at the University of Minnesota as a student. So one of those things I was thinking about is as your researchers are going forward in terms of budgeting and figuring out, because a lot of them are starting to lay out exactly what they're going to be doing in terms of research coming up in the next few years, are they building in contingency plans as far as what's going to happen with the people that are going to be doing the research, like students and whatnot, in order to be able to cover with the sick and safe time going forward? It's not like you can not show up and continue to not do the research. You need people there every day following up and collecting the data. So could you speak to that?
Madam Chair, Representative, we will not be able to have and cover contingency plans should our funds get cut off. We will have to do less research. We will have students that won't have funding on those projects. And we have projects that will end and we will be completed. Some of them will end midway. I've been asked by our faculty if we have a war chest to be able to dedicate to their research going forward. I think all of you well know we do not. Our money comes in either through tuition or through those grants, as has been delineated by my vice president. And if the research is cut off, then we will have many people lose their jobs, and we will have many students not have the opportunities both for the training as well as for the ongoing research experience that perhaps you got and others got that led to world experiences that made their next jobs, really wonderful and well prepared. So unfortunately, it would be a decimation of our research enterprise and our ability to perform the training and education that we need. I wish I had another answer. I'm wide open to the committee's ideas on that.
Okay. Representative Allen, good. Okay. Please continue. So we've got about a little less than 30 minutes left, and we do have a hard stop at a quarter to three.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Let's next move to the remainder of the O&M appropriation that isn't directed by riders. There are some overarching summary characteristics that might be helpful to understand as we talk about how the funds are allocated, used, and monitored. Number one, O&M literally supports all three missions of the university across all five campuses. It pays for faculty and those who provide all types of student services. It pays for direct research costs for faculty whose disciplines are not supported by the outside sponsors we've been talking about. It pays for much of the indirect costs of all research, both sponsored and non-sponsored, costs that are not reimbursed by the federal sponsors. And it pays for people and activities delivering on our public service mission, taking our discoveries out to farmers and rural communities through extension, or faculty working with local communities on solving local problems. Number two and number three on this list really go together here. At the college or campus level, the O&M appropriation is a separate revenue source, uniquely identified within our accounting system. However, because as we've discussed, the O&M appropriation and tuition are the largest unrestricted sources that we have, and they need to work together to deliver on our mission, the two sources are commingled as they are allocated out to departments for all of the spending. That means when a department spends O&M, or what we call O&M dollars, on a faculty member's compensation, for example, they're spending their combined allocation of state O&M appropriation and tuition. It is a much more efficient and effective way to do this and is more strategic. Number four, we allocate the appropriation in an incremental process, as we've discussed and as I will show you in an upcoming slide. And finally, number five, I'll share with you our oversight and monitoring processes and practices. So just a quick reminder back on this cycle slide very briefly, the black box again drives the process. The decisions we make on those significant planning variables lead to budget instructions and responses from units. We work through the budget process for our support units in the fall, determining what they need to be successful within our resource constraints. This involves understanding their services and their cost pressures, often due to inflation, including compensation and compliance requirements. And it involves discussing what it would mean for them to implement various levels of internal reallocation. Then we make preliminary decisions about incremental increases or decreases to their allocation for the next year based on all of those discussions. We meet with each one separately. After that, we then work through the process with each of our academic units in the winter spring. Again, meeting with them separately, reviewing their challenges and opportunities in much the same way, but with more variables, before arriving at our final proposed budget to take to the board. In each cycle, we meet with those support units first due to the structure of our budget model. So now we get to that right side of the previous chart, the attribution of the costs. As we discussed, the academic units generate and ultimately receive all of the revenues, including the state O&M appropriation. That means they have to have 100% of the costs. They use all of these revenues to pay for their direct costs of faculty and supplies and travel, et cetera. Plus, they have to pay for their proportionate share of the central support functions, which you see over on the right. And for that, we have created cost pools. We determine what the support units need to operate, and those total allocations are then distributed as charges to our academic units based on various formulas. It's a very transparent system where the academic units are told and understand what is driving the support costs of the institution, and they have the opportunity to raise questions and concerns about those decisions. By understanding how their activities generate costs directly through new debt service for new space, for example, or more generally by understanding how the number of students they enroll has an impact on student service costs, they can make better management decisions on behalf of the institution. It's in their best interest to hold down costs as best they can and to raise revenues to help pay for needed services in this type of a model. So when we meet with the academic units, we talk about their goals, their financial concerns, the direct costs they face, as well as those given to them through this cost pool process. And we also talk about their tuition projections and opportunities for other revenue growth and what we expect from them in terms of internal reallocation. We create a unit-level budget framework for balancing their incremental changes in resources and incremental changes in costs. And by the end of the process, as part of these unit-level frameworks, we have to make decisions unit by unit on how we need to make changes to the allocation of O&M dollars based on all of these variables and how they fit together. If we have an increase in the appropriation, we determine how to distribute those increases above base, driven by what we learn during the process. And the opposite is true for any decreases in the appropriation. By working through increases and decreases by unit, all designed to make each as successful as we can and to leverage their abilities to earn other revenues, we arrive at the recommended allocations we deliver to the board as part of the President's recommended all funds budget. I'll show you how this process results in the framework that represents the approved budget at the university level and then at the unit level on these next few slides. First, at the all university level for FY24, the first year of this last biennium, that year we received a $50 million increase in our O&M appropriation for core mission and some state appropriations and transfers for very specific items. We also implemented almost $40 million of internal reallocations or budget cuts again to free up existing resources. We raised additional tuition revenue and we accessed some one-time balances in order to pay for the incremental costs that are shown down below. So the $50 million of additional state core mission appropriation combined with the unit's reallocated funds and tuition revenue gains paid for the combined increase in the recurring cost categories that you see here. At the unit level, here's an example framework for that same year for one of our support units, the Office of the General Counsel. After going through the process and asking the questions that you see in the box, plus others that are more unique to each individual unit, in this case, we decided to increase their allocation by $192,000, and in red below, to implement $56,000 in budget cuts to reallocate existing revenues. And those two things combined paid for their compensation cost increases and a unique request from them related to an electronic portal for tracking the increased number of public data requests that we have received in recent years. That increase in the cost pool allocation of $192,000 then flows through to the next slide, which is a similar framework for an academic unit. In this case, the College of Food, Agriculture, and Natural Resource Sciences, again, for that same year. Since they received the revenue they generate, we were able to determine what tuition revenue gains they could apply to FY24 costs, along with a net increase in their O&M allocation of over $2 million from the $50 million increase we received, which combined with an expected internal reallocation or budget cut in red near the bottom of $778,000, that paid for their compensation cost increases, their overhead cost, which includes that cost pool charge increase, so their portion of the $192,000 from the previous slide, and then some strategic programmatic investments. We asked the same types of questions in the gray box of all of our units, as well as some very specific unit level, unique questions, and ultimately pull it all together in a way that balances each unit and thus balances the institution. As a result of this very robust budget review and decision-making process, every academic unit at the university receives some amount of state appropriation, which is the lime green portion of each bar on this chart. And as an aside, you can see the allocation of state funding to each of our units as part of the required 135A report that we have to submit to MMB and the state in the fall of each even-numbered year as part of the biennial budget process. As you can also see on this chart, the range of total revenues across these units obviously varies a great deal, and the mix of revenue types varies a lot. Some are much more dependent on tuition. If you look at the College of Liberal Arts, the Duluth campus, the Carlson School of Management, for example. And some are much more dependent on grants. Look at the medical school, the School of Public Health, and so forth. It is the combination of restricted appropriations and riders, our institutional goals and priorities, rising costs that can differ by activity and unit, and access to other revenues that ultimately determines the final level of O&M allocation as part of that green section. We work hard to keep every unit equally unhappy in the budget process and as successful as we possibly can. And the O&M appropriation is the glue that kind of holds it all together. As you can see from the example frameworks and a little understanding of our internal cost pool process, O&M in the academic units pays for all types of expenditures, those that exist in the academic units that receive it directly and those in the cost pool units that the academic units are then charged for. In the instruction lane, it supports 4-credit courses, non-credit and remedial courses, basic equipment and supplies in labs, classrooms and experiential spaces, classroom maintenance, cleaning, scheduling, and utilities, and student services and resources such as library materials, financial aid guidance, student advisors, course registration systems, disability resources, mental health services, tutoring, and on and on. In the research and discovery lane, it supports the grant application process, including faculty and staff time to develop and create proposals and generate data. And it supports costs not funded entirely by those external grants once awarded, things like compliance activities and systems, grant administration, management and accounting, lab and research space upkeep, utilities, cleaning, waste disposal, and on and on. And in the service to communities lane, it supports Minnesota Extension, the mobile dental clinic, our museums and public spaces, and so forth. It truly supports all of our missions across all of our campuses. You asked us to speak to how we steward these important funds, so I started to think about this in kind of a peeling the onion or layered kind of way. And at the very outer layer, we have certain laws, regulations, and rules placed on us by external entities, including the state, that require some level of tracking and reporting. That forces actions and behaviors on our part. Grants are a good example of this. Requiring reporting on the use of funds and the outcome of the work, so we have to create the mechanisms to do that reporting. Restricted appropriations are another good example of this, requiring that the funds be distributed within the university in a certain way, which forces us to create accounting rules and procedures and specific chart of accounts coding in order to ensure that that happens. These are not practices we put on ourselves, but are driven by others, and they lead to certain operating procedures in order to maintain compliance. In addition, some of the oversight and monitoring we do is in response to our own requirements for fiscal stewardship, driven by our institutional values and our priorities. So once inside the onion, so to speak, we have one layer that's very technical and detailed. We have accounting rules. Each state special appropriation, as I mentioned, is recorded in its own unique fund number, for example, so as to isolate that activity for tracking purposes. And we then train our accounting employees with a checklist that forces them to verify the correct chart strings are being used for each transaction, to assess the amounts and conditions of the transaction for compliance, allowability, proper justifications, and approvals. We have forced reconciliations. So MMB gives us a spreadsheet identifying our appropriations by legal citation and the 112 payment plan that they are implementing, which we then flow through to our accounting services to build our accounts receivable entries, which they then track during the year to ensure we receive payments as planned. At the highest level, the state funds come into the central accounts based on the receivables that we set up in the system, and then there's a second transaction that moves that funding out to units. As part of implementing that process, the units are required to budget those allocations in our system in a certain way, and the system actually forces the correct totals be entered or they can't move forward, which then drives the actual internal transactions to distribute the funds into accounts. In that way, we know the distribution matches the law in total and by unit as required. And of course, we have purchasing and travel policies that guide our spending to make sure expenditures meet institutional tests for legality and stewardship, controlling for allowability, reimbursement levels, competitive bidding requirements, and so forth. Moving to another layer, as we've discussed today, we have an accountability structure for financial management. There is one central budget office of 3 people and one central finance unit housing accounting, debt management, insurance purchasing, and so forth. but each of the 51 RRCs has a designated leader, a dean, a chancellor, a vice president, that is accountable for the financial health of their unit. And they have a designated chief financial manager that has a dotted line relationship back to the central structure. Together, they are responsible for a balanced budget and compliance with all policies. And in this structure, there's also a clearly defined chain of required approvals based on transaction type and magnitude, with some transactions requiring approval at the department level, some at the RRC level, some at a central level, and some even at the Board of Regents level. I would say at the same layer of the onion, we also have a robust budget review and development process that serves a strong monitoring function. We in the budget office regularly review for fiscal strength, employing a robust set of financial management reports to track annual operating balances at the unit level over time in order to uncover any emerging financial stress and developing structural imbalances, to track spending by funding category over time to look for anomalies and changes by expenditure category, and to track unanticipated changes in revenues when compared across years. We work with each impacted unit when there are questions about their financial strength to fully understand the situation and take corrective action if necessary. And finally, at a deeper level, we have an Office of Internal Audit that reports to our Board of Regents. That team works through an annual audit plan, reviewing transactions and actions for a revolving set of units across the institution for compliance with laws, regulations, and internal policies and procedures. Their audit plans and results are discussed and reported on through a standing committee of the Board of Regents. And when their findings require changes in operations or procedures, they work with the relevant leaders in the institution to ensure implementation of those changes in a reasonable time frame. That's just a quick overview of the landscape in this particular area of interest, but we would be happy to discuss these practices further in the future if it would be helpful to the committee. And finally, for today, we wanted to take this opportunity to highlight a portion of the biennial budget request approved by our Board of Regents. The proposal we submitted started through an idea gathering process centered on identifying our priorities. We sent out two surveys and held input sessions to flesh out the responses to those surveys and to add to them through engaged conversation. Faculty, staff, and students participated from across all of our campuses and many different types of units. Through that process and internal leadership conversations, we arrived at a strategy that emphasizes what's important to the university at this point in our history and remains true to our values. In total, we are requesting an increase to our O&M appropriation of $235 million across the biennium. Rather than try to explain incremental math, we felt it was simpler to identify our total needs and priorities for the two-year budgeting period. And if the state decides to provide additional funding to us, we're happy to take it in whichever year works best for you. Another way to look at it is that we're asking for four items, totaling a recurring increase of $235 million by the end of the biennium. One item under the theme of partnering with the state to maintain excellence, that's the core mission request, and then three items under the theme of providing options to move forward in key areas of importance. Today, we'll highlight just the top two on the list, and the second two will be discussed next week. Turning first to our partnering for excellence, our core mission request in more detail, as we all know, cost increases just don't stop. Our early estimates for incremental cost increases in the next biennium, just in the tuition and state appropriation funded portion of the budget, are shown here, again, as totals for the 2 years of the biennium. The categories should look somewhat familiar as they're consistent with the different framework views of the budget that I've shared with you today. The categories are not new. They represent our ongoing needs and priorities. First, we anticipate significant costs related to compensation and investment in our people. It is the people that make the university, and it will be the single largest planned spending increase in the university for the next biennium. This cost estimate of $157 million would be for increases across all of our employee groups on all of our campuses. In addition to the priority focus on our existing workforce, the remaining rows on this list are non-personnel and workforce expansion costs that must be addressed to maintain the excellence of the university. This includes the usual annual cost increases for utilities, leases, debt service, new building operations, plus beginning to address the enormity of deferred maintenance across the system in addition to approval of any HEPR appropriations. And that will require a planned significant investment in the next biennium. Moreover, through the annual budget process, we'll learn about needs over the next 2 years related to expanded student services, compliance activities, information security, administrative shortfalls, extraordinary inflation in some areas, safety enhancements, and so forth. And we have a strategic plan under development. Specific costs in these categories are brought forward, and the most critical must be funded to ensure delivery on the mission. We're proposing a partnership with the state to address these critical needs, asking for 45% of the total projected need, or $120 million of the $265 million plan. $235 million plan. That can be broken down as a request for $70 million for investment in our personnel over the next 2 years and $50 million for investment in our ongoing needs. For our part of the partnership, we commit to addressing the remaining 55% through increased dependence on other revenues and tuition revenue growth from enrollment gains where possible and rate changes, combined with continued internal spending cuts to free up existing resources. We are asking for your support to help keep the university strong. We have built a true economic engine that provides outstanding learning opportunities, critical services for students during their higher ed life, and as they prepare to move on, mind-boggling and practical research discoveries benefiting all people and places, and direct service to people where they live. People needing access to resources around health concerns, rural life, arts programming, and so forth. There are so many stories of success in these areas that we want to build on. And of course, none of that is done for free. The specific costs are many and varied, but together we can make the decisions necessary to address those costs and to invest in ways that make the university and the state of Minnesota even stronger. The second request we would like to address today is related to enhancing the student experience. And while I believe I have a colleague that can make her way up to the table today to discuss it in more detail, let me just say that the university has continually invested in the evolving needs of students. Within the base or the core budget that we have discussed today, we have made decisions over time to address items related to mental health, basic needs, career services, and so forth, raising additional revenues and shifting the use of existing dollars to remain relevant and responsive to what students want and need. But with additional funds, we can do so much more. We can go beyond just keeping pace to taking a big leap forward in support of our students. And I will let my colleague explain that opportunity in more depth.
Okay. Before we go there, Lead Wogelman has a question a ways back. But she didn't take a breath. So.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate it. Madam President, Madam Vice President, if we could go back to slide 32 and in taking a look at points of oversight, your internal policies, accountability structures. I'd like to follow up on a conversation that I first had with some members of the Board of Regents a couple of years ago when I first learned of an initiative to increase accountability, make internal dynamics more efficient and effective, called the PEAK Initiative. Could you please give us an update on the PEAK Initiative, how that's impacted your accountability structure, internal policies? It's my understanding that the PEAK Initiative has been in effect, so I'd be eager to hear of sort of how that's going, how you're tracking that, and then if there have been, I know it's still pretty new in effect, but if there have been any cost savings that have happened as a result of the restructuring from the PEAK Initiative, or any cost savings that are to be expected as a result of the restructuring from the PEAK Initiative.
President Cunningham.
Madam Chair, Representative Walker, I'll start and then hand it over again. We're just finished phase one and beginning phase two of four phases of the PEAK Initiative. The PEAK Initiative is designed to increase efficiency across our units, to increase efficiency across processes, and really in the same way that you update a building mechanics, to update our business operations to be modern and to be more efficient. So we're too early on in the process to be able to speak to the costs from that. We're just beginning phase two of phase four, and at the end of phase four in year 20...
To be determined.
We're a year or two. That's a long process that, and for an organization of our size. I wanted to also chime in to the note before on our request for part of our core mission is around compensation, just to remind the committee that we're the sixth largest employer, I think the fifth largest employer in the state. And before I came, there was wide analysis that's done that shows that our employees are not anywhere near market rate compensation. Many of our faculty are being paid at 25% rates for market compensation. Other staff are well below the market averages. And what that is doing is pushing those faculty to move on and take jobs other places. And so for us to be able to retain talent here in Minnesota and attract the talent to Minnesota, we attract a national workforce, but also employ many local folks, but we're not paying them at a compensation, and we believe that has to be addressed. And that's a key part of our plan for this year, is addressing the compensation of our faculty and our people and our staff. I know the question was raised before about enrollment and our total numbers for enrollment. I also just want the committee to understand that we cannot fix our budget problems over time by increasing enrollment. When we increase enrollment, we increase costs also. We also increase our financial aid. We increase the scholarships that go to that. We increase our utilities. We increase our building use costs. So there is certainly what is the right size for the university, but I just want to make sure no one here walks away thinking that we could simply make up for state funds by increasing enrollment, because that's not possible. Increasing enrollment actually increased costs. Remember that enrollment and the tuition is only 23% to 25% of our operating costs, and as you have more students, you actually have more costs. So I just want everyone to be clear and understand that, and I'm sorry I'm taking time away from our colleague.
So let's, because we have 3 minutes, we have a hard stop in 3 minutes. So let's finish up the presentation and we'll see how much time we have left after that. So please introduce yourself to the committee and then continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair Rarick. My name is Colleen McDonald. I am the Executive Director and Assistant Vice Provost of Boynton Health, and Boynton provides a number of services. So I'm excited here to talk to you about our enhancing the student experience with you. And we have a number of students in the audience who I've worked with over the time, so excited to see them as well. We have four areas that we want to increase over the next years. One is basic needs, student mental health, student academic supports, and career readiness efforts. And that's really to help students transition and have a successful entry into the workforce. So for basic needs specifically, we continue to see basic needs continuing to affect the student's ability and capacity to succeed in their college experience in many ways. We do a data survey every few years, and 1 in 4 students system-wide reported that food insecurity impacted their academics. And 1 in 3 students system-wide experienced housing insecurity. So those are pretty... It's a far cry from what we imagine students to be dealing with in terms of financial stress. When we presented in front of the Board of Regents, the student delegates talked about how most of them are working 2 or more jobs to stay in school and be successful. So this is not like stop doing the lattes at Starbucks. This is true food insecurity. We know that local context plays a pivotal role in how and when students are able to access needed resources such as nutritious food, affordable housing, transportation expenses. So I'll just give you an example of what this funding would set. One is in Duluth, the funds would allow the campus to hire a basic needs coordinator, purchase additional fresh frozen food for their food pantry, and fund student health workers. In Rochester, funds would support the current food pantry model and offer greater access. In the Twin Cities, it would allow us to expand the Nutritious U food pantry to be more held several times a month, as well as on different parts of the campus where students are struggling. In the student mental health component, we know that about 57% of our students report being diagnosed with one mental health condition in their lifetime, and 26% reported being diagnosed with one mental health condition. Our main ask for student mental health is that we can really significantly expand the workforce that we have across all system campuses. We would like to hire more therapists, counselors, as well as psychiatrists to help students be successful in their educational goals. I'm going to wrap it up. And then our last two asks are to increase our academic support services as well as our career entry services so that students can be successful while they're on campus and then move into the workforce. Thank you.
Thank you for your presentation. We have 1 minute. So I'm just going to wrap up real quick because you will be back. They will all be back, I promise. This, we're going to do an unprecedented thing. Committee, they're going to be here 3 full days. We have never had the University of Minnesota in front of this committee for 3 full days. So there was plenty of time to have member discussion, ask more questions. So hang on to your hats, hang on to your thoughts, hang on to your questions, and they will be back for 2 days next week and go quite in depth as to what they have done with the, not just the O&M, but the riders and the state appropriations, the state specials as well. Yeah, I know. So with that, we are adjourned, and we'll see you next week.